My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
If you live basically anywhere in Eastern Canada, you don't need me to tell you it's been cold.
The extreme cold weather alert was issued this morning by Toronto's Chief Medical Officer of Health. The temperature is drastically dropping.
The seniors' residence right behind me in Montreal East became a crime scene on Sunday after the matriarch of a powerful political family froze to death in their courtyard.
Ottawa claimed a chilling record over the weekend, the coldest capital anywhere in the world at minus 26.
And in the middle of a deep freeze that's broken records and frozen Niagara Falls, there are always people with nowhere to go.
Advocates for those living on Toronto streets are calling on the city to declare homelessness a state of emergency.
It's really, really stressful. The city doesn't want to help us. They don't want to build apartments for the homeless.
This happens in many cities every winter, but in Toronto in January, with the city already in the middle of a housing crisis that has pushed rent beyond the means of some people already earning a stable income, and a shelter system that's packed to the bursting point, the situation is even more precarious for those without jobs, or friends, or anywhere else to go. So they band together, and they live as best as they possibly can. This is what it's like for groups of people who have nowhere to go except under the overpass, and nobody to turn to except one another. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Mae Warren is a reporter for the Toronto Star who, in the middle of the city's latest severe cold snap, went under the Gardiner, the expressway that runs through downtown Toronto, to ask the small community living there why they stay and what other options the city has for them. Describe the community that exists under the Gardiner that you visited.
Yeah, so at different spots under the Gardiner, kind of close to the lakeshore, there are different tents and some just like sleeping bags or kind of little camps. So the one that we visited was around like Spadina and Bathurst, and you kind of walk in kind of around, you know, the freeway with the highway, with the cars and everything. Mm-hmm. And then there's just kind of like this big expanse of like dirt and unused land. Basically, there's nothing there except for, you know, maybe six or seven scattered tents. There's like camping tents, and some of them have like sleeping bags on top of them. They have like a lot of like garbage and things around them. I think some of that's actually the possessions of the people that live there.
Right.
And then there's also just a ton of garbage around. But it's like a little community, as you say,
right,
of people that have kind of set up camp there. Because they don't really have anywhere else to go, or they would prefer to be there than the other options.
So why there?
I think just because it's a little bit secluded and it's a little bit like private almost. There's like you have the pillars from the Gardiner and a little bit of, and like the underbelly of the expressway and a little bit of shelter from like the wind and the rain and the snow. And it's just kind of a private spot. Like, it's not
right
in the middle of Bay Street, and no one's going to be stepping over you. And when we went in, like, everybody was inside their tents because mm-hmm. it was really, really cold that day. It was last week.
Yeah, we should emphasize that it's been, like,
yeah,
minus 20 degrees for, like,
seven days.
Now.
Yeah, I think that day it was, like, feels like minus 10 or something, but I was freezing, and they were all in their tents. And we actually kind of just walked around and we were calling out like, hello, like, could we bother you? Like, we're from the Star. We just wanted to chat with you because we heard there was some issues with, you know, evictions from the city, and just kind of looked around at all the different tents. And then there was actually one that we went up to, which no one answered. Actually, we called out to this guy and he was like, no comment. And he's inside the tent. But it was a really like innovative setup. It had, I'm sure it's not that safe, but it had a little like chimney and
okay,
a little like wood stove inside. And you could see there was like a single light bulb. So he somehow had electricity in there and some kind of heat from the stove. So it was almost like a little shanty cabin almost. That was the most advanced one that we saw.
So these are not temporary dwellings, or at least they're not setting them up that way.
Yeah, they didn't look like that. And again, it's hard to make generalizations because, you know, that's just what we saw that day. And, you know, maybe a couple of them were, but they seemed like they'd put effort into them for sure. There was another tent where there were these like egg cartons outside, and there were water bottles inside them and like stones inside them to like keep the tent tied down.
Right.
And it just seemed like very purposeful, and like they'd either brought their own possessions or they'd kind of scavenge possessions from this nearby expanse of garbage, which we also kind of walked around a little bit. Old mattresses or couches or things like that. And we also saw propane tanks because people were using them for heat or for food, which is pretty dangerous with the nylon of the tents.
How long have these camps existed in one form or another? Because they seem pretty ubiquitous as you travel along the Gardner.
Yeah, so the people that we talked to, maybe the three or four men, one of them said, I've been here for about 2 years on and off. Another one said, I've been here about 5 or 6 years. So at least that long. And I just did a bit of research myself because I'm kind of new to the topic and found articles, you know, from a few years ago. So I think they've definitely been around.
Mm-hmm.
One advocate that I spoke to for this story told me that anecdotally there seems to be a few more these days, maybe just because of the housing crisis and the homelessness crisis kind of intensifying a little bit. So it's not really a new thing, but it's something that kind of we kind of rediscover every winter or talking about.
That's why I wanted to talk to you, because this is one of those stories that seems to surface. And you, like, to your point, you can go back and kind of Google homeless camps, Gardner, and see stories from years and years and years ago. And there's always discussions about efforts are being made to move these people, or the city has issued notices, or somebody has said this is unsafe, and they remain.
Yeah.
Why hasn't anything been done? And what do the people under there say about why they're still there and why they're not in shelters? Because I know that's where the city wants them to go.
I think the people that we talk to, they mentioned that shelters are very crowded right mm-hmm. now, and we know that from the city stats. You know, you're sleeping maybe very close to some stranger, 100 people in a room on mats with maybe just a couple feet apart. A lot of shelters, you can't bring pets. We talked to one guy who had a dog that meant a lot to him. There's bed bugs sometimes, not to knock the shelters, but it's, you know, as if you're in this crisis situation and you don't have your stuff and you don't have your privacy. And really talking to them, kind of trying to put myself in their shoes, I think they just wanted their little tiny sliver of privacy. It's just a tiny tent, but at least it's their own and they can have their stuff in there and they can have their dog in there. And they know that no one's going to bother them in there. Also, you know, some of them have addiction issues and mental health issues, and there are issues with when you go into shelters, you know, maybe you get into a fight with someone,
mm-hmm.
they don't want you to come back or something like that. As to why nothing's been done about it, I think it's just a really complex, tricky problem. And, you know, every winter now we're hearing about these packed shelters and seeing stuff like this, the effect of it.
But the city tries.
They try to move them and
nothing happens. And I don't mean to say that's a criticism of either the homeless people or the city, but nothing's been done.
Yeah, and it does seem to be kind of a perennial problem. I think one thing that was interesting to me, because I could definitely see both sides of it, and how do you fix this, really? And yes, it's nice that they have a community there, but it is unsafe to have propane tanks in tents, and you can't just have tent cities spring up. I can see the mayor's argument for why, you know, they're not keen on it. But one of the advocates that I talked to said that actually, there was a coroner's inquest, which was done after this man named Grant Faulkner burned to death in this shanty shack that he'd set up because he had a propane tank. Had a lot of interesting recommendations, things like working with the people there on fire safety, or, you know, going down there and telling them, you know, maybe this propane tank and this nylon tent is not the best thing.
Right. Or if they say it's minus 20 degrees and cold.
Yeah. I mean, maybe there's something they could do about that, or maybe, you know, handing out more survival supplies mm-hmm. or something, you know, and some people will say you just need more shelter spaces. I think the real thing right now is that there's just nowhere for them to go because there aren't any apartments, really. There's just such a housing crisis that it's hard to imagine that they would find anywhere to go.
Right. And we talked to your colleague, Emily Matthew, a month or two ago about the apartment crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And that plays into the shelter crisis, too, because theoretically, I think it should be a cycle, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody moves from a tent under the Gardner mm-hmm. to a shelter. Mm-hmm. Somebody from a shelter moves from a shelter into an apartment, mm-hmm. but nobody's moving from the shelters right now.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have an idea how crowded they are?
Yeah, so the city has a webpage where every night it posts like how crowded they were, and you can see like for family shelters, men's, women, co-ed. And I think for this article, I checked it for that day, and it was between 97 and 100%. So the city will say there are spaces, some spaces available, even though that is very crowded.
But how do they know where to go?
That's a good question. I mean, I think word of mouth, and there are city outreach staff that will go out and say, you know, this place has a place, we'll call 311 for you and figure it out or whatever. But I know there were some issues last year. The city ombudsman found that the city had given bad information, like that was incorrect about capacity. And also when it's that crowded, I think one advocate told me they're like averaging the numbers. So even if it's like technically 98%, that means maybe one space at this place, one space. So if you're going to a few, you know, you can imagine that would get really stressful and difficult. And to your point about the people moving along the steps, I think to me, the big issue right now is that young professionals, like people who have jobs and are like paying taxes and everything, are having trouble finding apartments in the city.
Yeah.
So what landlord is going to give some guy who's been homeless for 5 years and has, you know, mental health issues and addiction issues an apartment? Like there's just such little supply that I think the whole layer of people who might have been precariously on the edge of homelessness are then just homeless or more trapped in that cycle because there's just not options for them anymore.
The people you talk to under the Gardener, have they tried to take advantage of city programs and sort of get into that cycle that's supposed to eventually lead to a roof?
Yeah, so I talked to one man who had been living there on and off for 2 years, and he said that he'd actually been assigned like a streets to homes worker with the city whose job it is to kind of get him into more permanent housing.
You know, right.
Shelter as a band-aid if that's what you need for tonight, but let's try and get you into something. And he said that he'd been trying to contact them and that, you know, was unsuccessful at that and was feeling frustrated because he really wanted to get into something and he didn't want to be out there and he tried to get his addiction issues under control and et cetera, but he just felt that that wasn't working for him.
Do we have any idea, because I know John Tory has been asked this question, what options the city is considering? We know they want to evict people from under the Gardener. We know that the shelters are packed. What's John Tory going to do?
Yeah, it's a good question. We asked the city, not John Tory, but the city communications person that, and they said, you know, we don't want to speculate. So it's not really clear. Like, they could get the police to come and break it up. That would look very bad on their part, probably, if there was a dramatic, like, clearing out. But I think it has happened before. Here in Toronto, there was a camp that was cleared out in 2002. And I think that's happened also recently in Vancouver. So there'd definitely be a precedent for that. And I think they have the authority to do that for sure. And again, I can see from their point of view, like, there are public safety issues. But it's just tough because then you're coming in and you're breaking up, you know, the one staple thing in their life. Maybe they're separated from their pet, their belongings, their limited belongings are gone. And, you know, to us, it might look like just some garbage, but to them, that's all of their stuff and their survival, you know, supplies. So I could see how, especially if you're, you know, living very precariously and are like one step away from some addiction issue, something like that might really push you into a downward spiral because that's what you have right now.
What is the one thing that we get wrong about these communities when we write about them without spending time in them?
I think for me, the biggest thing that I took away from talking to people and going there and spending time was just that I could then see why someone would prefer that to a shelter. Not to say that's the right choice, but it just helped me to understand why they were there and why it might be more complicated than just saying, hey, you can't be on city property. And just seeing the permanence as well and the thought that they'd put into setting up their own little place, you know, like having a wood stove or electricity, that's something that they've really like put some time into. And
it's a home.
Yeah, it's a home. Exactly. Like it is a home. It's the closest thing that they have. And while it might be just a very small tent that's only enough room for like a person and a dog and a few things, like that's still more personal space than they're getting in a shelter. And they don't have to move around every day and pick up their stuff and when they leave, you know?
What do they think the city should be doing?
They just kind of want to be left alone. And they mentioned that a couple times, like, what else are they using this land for? Like, the city has better things to do than to, you know, bother these innocent people.
Do they like reporters from the Toronto Star coming around?
They were surprisingly willing to chat. People that we talked to, they're, you know, friendly and open and seem to, you know, not have any issues with even giving their names, which is something you struggle with when you're reading, you know, even people who are doing great in life sometimes just don't want to give their names to reporters. But they really kind of wanted to be left alone. That's kind of the impression that I got from the city. Not that they didn't want to talk to anyone, because they were very friendly and open, but just that they didn't want to have to leave.
How much of a sense of, I know I've called it a community, but how much of a sense of community is it? Do they have, are they neighbors in the sense that we would consider people who live in permanent dwellings neighbors? Like what kind of level of comfort do they have down there?
Yeah, I mean, just from my couple hours of being there, it seemed that they did kind of have that a little bit of a neighborly aspect. And the one quote that stood out for me that one man told me was that, you know, they check on each other. You know, they are there for each other in that way of like, you know, if it's a cold night or something, maybe you just check on that other person. And I think that when you're out on the streets by yourself and you don't have your family or anything, that probably means, you know, a lot to someone. And even when we were there, we noticed like people, you know, coming over to their friends and saying hi or greeting people or whatever. And they seem to know each other a little bit. And there were also people who didn't have tents there, but said that they came and stayed sometimes in the tents. So it wasn't just one person maybe that was getting the benefit of that shelter. Other people would come sometimes as well and get it, which was interesting. And it seemed also like a destination. Like we spoke to one man who had just been homeless since Christmas and he didn't have a tent there, but he said, you know, I just thought maybe there'd be some people here I could connect with and thought it might be worth checking out, and seemed like he kind of, you know, just came down some days just to have that connection, I guess.
What happens if the city does take these tents down or evict these people? Do you have any sense of where they'll go?
I really get the sense that they really don't have any other option. I mean, if they could go to a shelter, and that's probably where they'll try and end up. But what concerns me is just like, you know, what if they try one shelter and that shelter's full, and then they, you know, you get confused and it's cold and you're tired, and then, you know, you just end up sleeping on the street, and then you don't have any shelter. You don't have the shelter of the tent or your, you know, propane heat or the shelter of the gardener from the elements. So then you have a situation where, you know, you're just, God forbid, like sleeping outside. I could see how someone could die from that, which is really scary. And that's certainly what advocates say is a concern. Now, on the flip side, I see the city's argument that you could also die from your propane tank lighting your tent on fire.
Right.
Which is fair. But I just got the sense that they really did not have anywhere else to go, and that this, you know, these people are already so down and struggling so much, and this is the one little bit of home that they've created, and also almost, like, I wouldn't say that they're proud of them, but they've put effort into this, and they've tried to make their situation as good as they can in a very difficult time. And then for someone to come and, like, wreck that or take their possessions or, you know, throw out their stuff, I could see that being really, really hard, especially when they're already really vulnerable. You know, a couple of them said that they, you know, have issues with their family and they can't go home, and that they tried to get apartments and it hadn't worked out, and they didn't seem to have jobs, any of the ones that I talked to. So it just kind of that negative cycle, and it feels like it would push them further into it.
Are you going to go back and check on them when the 14 days are up?
Yeah, I think it would definitely make sense. We've kind of been like, I've been not working this weekend, but like colleagues have been checking in with advocates and things.
How bad is it out there? This is the bad cold snap for Toronto, for most of Eastern Canada. How bad do the people out there watching out for people who are living rough say it is right now?
Yeah, I think they're very, very concerned because it's so cold right now. Like even walking around, you can feel it's really tough. So for somebody that's sleeping outside or even sleeping in a tent, they're really worried. I think they're doing a lot. They're kicking up their street outreach, and they are checking on people for sure. But yeah, definitely we want to continue to follow this story and see how they're doing, see what the city's response is. I mean, it's possible the city might just be like, okay, well, we gave them the notice and they didn't leave, so moving on, you know?
Which seems to have happened
before.
Many times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and I could see from their point of view, they might want to have some big dramatic scene of kicking out people in the freezing cold. But I guess we'll see.
Thanks, May.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
May Warren, reporter with the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca and check out some other episodes or suggest one to us. There's a contact us form. You can find us and all our other shows on frequencypodcastnetwork.com. And we want your reviews, your ratings, any comments you have. You can find us on Apple, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on Google, and on Twitter, at TheBigStoryFPN. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.